This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. It is Trainer Talk presented by Basic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again, broadcasting from our Lexington, Kentucky studios and welcoming all of you joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM Channel 206, and everyone tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, your smartphone, or on your tablet. It's all there for you at horseracingradio.net. Every week I have the opportunity to visit with so many of the people that make our sport a success. I tell you that each and every Wednesday evening. And tonight, no exception, a couple of outstanding trainers joining me on Trainer Talk. Number one, that's Howard Wolfendale. He's going to be with me for the first half of the program. In the second half, I'll visit with Arnaud Delacour, who has only been at it for a few years, but already off to a great start. And we'll tell you their stories here this evening over the course of the next hour. So happy to have you on board, and happy to have Howard Wolfendale on board for the first half of the program. The 58-year-old native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has trained more than 1,500 winners, and his runners have earned more than $21 million in purses, and he's with us now here on Trainer Talk. Howard, thanks for taking the time.
You're quite welcome.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And I guess maybe better known now as Maggie Wolfendale's father, because she's becoming quite famous in her own right.
I get that a lot.
Yeah, she's becoming quite famous
now.
That's
a good thing, though.
It is a good thing. And she's recently married, by the way. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, now this was a wedding that took place overseas, though, didn't it?
Right, in England.
How was that experience for you?
Oh, it was great. I mean, it's the first time I was out of country, and, you know, I mean, it was really, really nice. The wedding went really well, and everybody had a good time.
Did you get a chance to make it to Royal Ascot?
I was supposed to, but we had a pub crawl in London the day before, and I couldn't crawl out of bed the next day, so I passed. I wish I would have now, but, you know, hindsight. Everybody else went to, with us, but I didn't make it. I couldn't handle the walking around anymore.
Hey, well, look, I mean, you're not an old guy by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, that takes its toll, doesn't it?
Yeah. I got a bad back now these days, and it just gets to you once walking around, staying around.
No, well, that's great. And you have to be extremely proud of her and everything that she's accomplished. And, of course, now the television voice of Naira and doing everything pre- and post-race in the paddock. She does a phenomenal job.
Yeah, she does. I mean, she's everybody, you know, says nothing but good things about her, and I'm really proud of her. Really, really proud of her.
Yeah, I can imagine. The first time we had the chance to meet her was in 2008. It was our very first broadcast of the Preakness here on HRN, and she was Miss Preakness in 2008. And that was cool. We actually interviewed her on the show, and you kind of knew right away that she had that it factor when you put the microphone in front of her, and she was going to be successful.
Yeah, she wanted to do that since she was, I mean, 7-8 years old when we go to the races, and she watched the guy on TV giving his picks, and said, "I can do that, and I can do that." That's all she wanted to do.
Well, it's easy to see how she got hooked on the sport. How about you, Howard? Let's go back to the beginning. And you are born in Pittsburgh. How did you become a fan of horse racing?
Well, the whole family was, you know, we had show horses. You know, I mean, I'm the only one that didn't get past lead line. So everybody else did pretty good showing horses. And then my older brother got hooked up with a guy, because back then it was Waterford Park. It was only, you know, 45 minutes or so from where we lived, and he started going down there, and sooner, you know, before you know it, he had a couple of horses, and he got his trainer's license, and then it all evolved from there.
So what do you remember about the first time that you actually went to a racetrack?
I was young, and 7 or 8. It just blew me away. I mean, you know, I liked it from the get-go, you know. And just, you know, being around the horses, we always had the horses and stuff. And then, you know, they didn't run in the winter, and all the horses he had used to come back to the farm, you know. And I got to be around them then. I just knew that's what I wanted to do at a young age.
Really? So there was never anything else that crossed your mind and you said, hey, maybe I'll do something else instead of training horses? This was always it for you?
No. I wish it would have been a blacksmith looking back on it, or a vet or something. Training's been fucking good to me, so.
Well, you know, it's funny. We talk about that a lot on this program, and I've had the chance to visit with so many different trainers, and everybody has a different way that they got started and that they got to where they are today. And for you, it was just something that you were passionate about from a very young age, and it just seems like everything's kind of clicked, even though I understand it's not an easy profession, is it?
Oh, no, not at all. But, you know, my older brother, you know, I worked for him on the farm. You know, he had a little farm after we moved to down by Waterford. You know, I went and ended up finishing school down there. But, you know, I used to work on the weekends and I'd feed the horses on the farm and all that stuff. So I was only 13, 14 then. So I probably owned my first horse when I was 14 or something. Half trained him, I guess.
How much older is your brother than you?
He's 12 years older than I am, so.
Okay. So was he a good teacher?
Oh, yeah. 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 He did well from the get-go when he got in. He come up under one of the better trainers back in at Waterford, and he went on his own real quick and got, you know, he had 30, 40 horses within a year or so. I mean, he took off real good. Real quick.
Wow. Who did he work with at Waterford?
It was Richard Beach. I mean, that's going back into the early 60s now. 63,
sure.
64, something like that.
So what's the biggest thing that you were able to learn as you were watching him and working around him?
Well, you know, that's a cheap track. You know, most of the horses all had physical problems, you know, just how to work on them, how to, you know, and he always said most horses are overtrained. You know, he learned how to, you know, once they're fit, just keep them happy and, you know, take care of their ailments, and they're going to run for you usually. And I've stuck with that most of my career.
Yeah, and it seemed to work out pretty well. And you said your brother got off to a really fast start when he started training horses. How about you, when you first took out your license and went out on your own? What were those early days like for Howard Wolfendale?
Well, I had all intentions to. I was at Penn National at the time. They had a strike, I think it was 76, Bowie, Mutual Clerks or something, I don't know. But then my brother sent me up to Penn National with 3 or 4 horses, and I had one horse of my own. I wasn't a trainer yet, you know, they were still running his name's trainer. And then they end up being claimed. Well, I don't know what happened, but I ended up staying over that summer, and I met my wife up there, and I went to work for Robert Wheeler. I really learned a lot from him. You know, I mean, he was an old school horseman, and he really knew how to take care of legs and lighten up. I mean, most of the ones we took them out in this field and just figure eighted, jogged them in the figure eight, and they just run their eyeballs out and let them over there. So we had intention of coming back because my brother was going to New Orleans, and we said, I was only 20 or 21, I'm afraid, but we was going to tag along with him, go to New Orleans just to, you know, have a good time and work for him down there. And he ended up talking me into staying at Bowie with we had like 18, 20 head, I think. And I got my trainer's license, and here you go. So he'd come back once every couple of weeks or something. But, you know, he pretty much left it up to me what to do with him. We did pretty good. I mean, we went 12 races that I mean, he was like fourth leading trainer behind, you know, Leatherberry, Dope, and Tamaro.
Wow.
You know, we did good that first, you know. Then when he came back, you know, I had enough money to claim a few of my own, and I just kind of half worked for him and, you know, trained my own horses. But we survived.
Yeah, I know. I read where your first winner came, what, 1977. You were 21 years old, and it came at Laurel Park with a horse by the name of Red Lace. What do you remember about that day?
It was, I don't know how many horses I saddled before that, but she was just, I think she ended up winning, that was later in the year. I mean, but I think she went 12 races that year. She was just a machine. I was ecstatic.
Did you do another pub crawl after that?
No, we didn't have too much time for too much drinking, pub crawling back in those days. we had short help, and we worked from sun up to sundown. We were done after that day was over.
You know, you talked about finally getting some money to claim some horses on your own, and you've had a lot of success in this sport, more than 1,500 winners, and many of those have come with those hard-knocking claimers. And that's, right. You know, quite honestly, Howard, that's an art form in itself, to be able to pick out the right horse, move them up the ladder, whatever it might be. And talk about that. Talk about that end of the game and being successful in the claiming game.
Well, I mean, when you're claiming, you should. A lot of people don't. They just claim off the paper. But I like going down, you know, looking at a horse a race or two before I claim them, just to see what they look like physically and all that, and their legs, who's got them, and, you know, there looks like there's room for improvement. But the bottom line is, you know, if they can run, they can run. I mean, you got to make a slow horse run faster, but see something you think you can improve, you know, physically or mentally, and you reach in and grab them.
So when you go to claim a horse, what are you looking? Are you looking at the past performances? Are you looking at them physically? What are you looking for to find that right individual?
Well, I mean, first, you know, they do have to have some kind of, you know, either back class, or you see one starting to get good. You know, and then I always look at them before I claim. If I get, you know, if you got time, some get there late, you know, you have to look at them before. And I like to watch the replays and all that, and make sure they're switching leads when they're supposed to, and how they move and all that. And basically that's about it. But
yeah, it's an art form. It's different than making a living with running with high end stakes horses, isn't it?
Totally. I mean, that's one thing I wish I would have done early in my career, is going to work with somebody that had those kind of horses, you know, just spend 6 months or a year just being around those kind of horses and see, because I know they got to be trained different from the claimers, most of them, you know. So I wish I would have done that, but they just kind of took off, and I said, I ain't gonna quit now. Training good work for somebody. So,
what's the biggest difference when you are training a horse that's, say, you know, grade one, grade two level, and then training a horse that's running in a 12.5 claimer? What's the biggest difference in that approach, Howard?
Well, I mean, you got every horse is an individual. You just gotta, you know, realize how much training they do need, what. You know, just like I said, you just got to keep them happy. And, you know, once they're fit, you know, 9 out of 10 of them don't need, you know, a lot of work, as long as, you know, they're running every 2 weeks or 3 weeks. I mean, after that, you got to do a little more something with them. But them horses don't like to see that racetrack every day, the majority of them, you know.
talking with trainer Howard Wolfendale here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Howard, I'm going to go back to another day that I know has to be very special for you, and that was February 21st, 2005, when you sent out Warrison to win at Laurel Park, and that was a milestone win for you. It was win number 1,000. Take me back to that day and look back on that milestone for a minute.
Well, that was another night, you know. I was sitting on that, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but then they made me aware. I was sitting on 999. And back then, yeah, we were winning, you know, 2, 3, 4 races a week. I think it seemed like at least a month or 6 weeks before that one finally came. You know, I was stuck on that number just like I was on this 1,500 one. I mean, but it was, I mean, everybody, all my friends and everybody got in the picture, even some of the waitresses and stuff, and they were in the picture and everything. I mean, it was a good time.
So you didn't even know that you were getting close to it until somebody told you?
No, right. I you know, like 2 weeks into it, you know, and then somebody from the publicity department says, you know, you're sitting on 999. I said, oh, no wonder I can't win a race.
Were you hoping that they didn't?
No, I don't keep track of that too much. I mean, but this last one, it was.
Yeah, were you wishing they didn't tell you after that?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I've had a lot of trainers tell me when they get close to that milestone that it really does start to kind of weigh on you a little bit, and you're thinking, just get it over with.
It definitely does. They're right. Get it over with. Let's go.
Yeah. Well, I know that was the reaction you had after you won your 1,500th win, which came this past April, April 11th at Pimlico. And I know your reaction was much more of relief than excitement, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And it took a while to get that win.
I had to win a race all year. And I knew about it the whole time because they even had a sign made up at Laurel, and they got tired of every time I had a horse in, they'd have it ready. That TV, a guy had to bring a special camera down. And the guy goes, I'm getting tired of lugging this thing down, this camera down here. they had to make a new sign up for Pimlico, you know. It just drug on a long, long time.
Well, I know I read where you said that it was a total team effort, and you've said that several times in your career. You don't do it alone. And I know your wife, Tammy, who you mentioned, is an integral part of your operation. And another name you mentioned was a gentleman by the name of Gurley. Now, tell me about this story.
Well, I mean, he's an owner I still have now. I mean, he's the one that won the 1,500. He's actually more excited than I was. But he's a really nice guy. I mean, I probably been training for him 4 or 5 years now. But just to do anything for you, I mean, just as generous as they, you know, you're at the races with him. You don't, you know, he picks everything. I mean, he's just a really, really good guy and just laid back. Just all he wants to do is have a good time. And, you know, if you make money, they make money. If you, you know. But he's a super guy. I mean, yesterday or day before yesterday, I ran a horse at Delaware, one of his, and he sent a guy over driving me down. You know, I said, you don't have to do that. I know how to get there. He paid the guy to come pick me up, me and Tammy up, and drive us to Delaware. That's the kind of guy he is.
Wow. Well, how long has he been with you?
I think it's 5, 6 years. I mean, right around there.
Yep.
I can't, Well, we've done all right together. I mean, he ain't got hasn't got any real stars yet, but he will. He deserves it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, and how about Tammy? Talk about what she's meant to your operation and working with her.
From day one, I mean, it's been, you know, she's out there every day with me. I mean, it's, you know, even when Maggie was a little baby, she'd come to the barn with her. We put her in a swing in the tack room. she was there every day, almost except when her grandmother watched her. But mostly she was out there every day. And Tammy used to gallop for me, before. I mean, she'd still gallop for me after Maggie and for a good while. And then she slipped on some ice and broke her ankle or leg. Pretty bad, and she hasn't really job since, but she's out there still out every day. You know, she does the books. She does, you know, keeps me straight anyway.
Well, I can imagine that's a bit of a challenge, though. You're working with your wife, and a lot of people make that work, right? Yeah. How does that work? You go home at night, and maybe things didn't go quite so well. How does that work?
Yeah, you know, it's not always real good, but we've managed to survive the storm quite a few times. But it does. I mean, when you're work, you know, it's hard to work with your wife, you know, 24/7. It gets hard, but she puts up with me, and that's the main thing.
Yeah, well, and I can imagine that when she was getting on your horses, to have somebody there that could tell you exactly what they were feeling underneath them in the mornings, that had to be a huge asset for you.
All right. I've been lucky as far as that's concerned, you know, because my younger brother was getting on them before she was, and then she galloped for years and years, and then when she got hurt, then Maggie started galloping, and you know, I've been, you know, fortunate to have her up. Now my nephew's galloping for me, so I've been fortunate to have family getting on these horses, which makes a big, big difference.
Wow. What's your nephew's name, Howard?
Scott.
Scott, does he want to be a jockey at some point?
Nah, he's taller than I am. He's a spring bean, but he's plenty tall. He's rode in some amateur races, but now they've weeded him out of that too. So he would have liked to have been, but he's probably 6'2" probably now.
Oh wow!
But yeah, but he's into the game big time too. You know, he's got his own horse. You know, he's still gals for me and the guy on the other side, and he's a worker, and he's got the work ethic anyway, which is important in this game.
Yeah, well, you don't get anywhere without that. That's for sure.
Right.
How many horses do you have in training now?
I only got 9 right now.
Okay. Well, I know the one horse that you'll probably never forget goes back to, 2011 or so, when Bold Affair burst onto the scene and rattled off, 9 stakes victories for you in a couple of years?
Yeah, she was special. I mean, you could tell she was a real deal from the get-go, but she had physical problems and mental problems. She was some days you couldn't even catch her. Luckily, there was a hole in the back of the stall, and they had to catch her from the other side. Some days.
Oh, you're kidding me.
She was had a corpse now, but she was a runner. She was the best one I ever had, that's for sure.
What was different about training her as opposed to some of the other horses you've been around?
I had another horse named Colonel Hill that you know, I had from a 2-year-old, you know, he actually went a stake his first time out of his life. And I took a little bit from him, but he didn't have all the physical and mental problems just that Philly had. She needed training, but you knew when to back off of her too. And she'd tell you, I mean, she wasn't a good doer. She didn't, you know, she's tough keeping a tub, and, you know, she had multiple minor injuries that held us up here and there, but we got her right and let her over there if she was going to run. I mean, she was something. I mean, she was tall, so she was close to 17 hands probably. She was big.
Wow. How many Bold Affair pictures do you have in your office and in your house?
I got all the I'm downstairs right now. I got all her stake wins on the floor here. I got all of them. And just pictures of her, you know, galloping back after she run, a couple of her just, you know. Now, she takes up a lot of downstairs.
Wow. That's great. When you have a horse like that, it really does stick with you for a long time. And it's a great memory to have, to be able to go down and look at those pictures and kind of reflect on those times for sure. You know, you train mostly in the Mid-Atlantic states, and in Maryland, there's a gentleman by the name of King Leatherberry who will be inducted into the Hall of Fame later this year. But in 1999, you were named Outstanding Trainer by the Maryland Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association, and that had to be just a tremendous honor for you.
Yeah, because they just started that the year before. I think Dale Capuano went it the year before, and then I went it the next year. And, that was, we did have a really good year that year. This game's all right. but 6 years later, I was down to six horses. That's how quick you can change on it, Because the guy I was training for back in really got me started was Rocco D'Amelio, and he was just a class act, and he really got us rolling from the get go, and he kind of got away from it a little bit and got down on horses and scrounged around for new owners, and they were hard to come by back in those days.
Oh, yeah. No, I can imagine. And what a thrill for you. And to be part of that history now in Maryland really certainly means a lot. I know it means a lot to you, and it means a lot to racing fans as well. Howard, only about a minute left, but I always like to end by asking trainers what else they like to do outside of racing. So do you have any other hobbies or follow any sports or anything like that?
Well, we used to play golf twice a week, but I haven't picked the club up in probably a year and a half now since my back's going on me. But I love football. I look forward to that every year. I like baseball. I like to watch the Orioles. Other than that, I used to like to fish, but I don't have time for that much anymore.
Yeah. Well, as somebody who was born in Pittsburgh, do you still bleed black and gold?
No, I never was a big Pittsburgh fan, believe it or not. I was a Redskins fan before I even moved down here. But I wish, way they are these days, I don't know. I was back there when most of their championships Pittsburgh did. I never was a Pittsburgh fan for some reason.
Wow. Howard Wolfendale here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Howard, you told me that you didn't think you could spend 30 minutes talking about yourself, but guess what? You just did it.
Congratulations.
Yeah, well done. Another milestone for you. Howard Wolfendale. Right. Howard, really appreciate the time. And like all of our guests, you're going to receive a gift from one of our sponsors. It's Flair Equine Nasal Strips. I'll get those up to you. And we'll look forward to catching up with you soon. And all the best moving forward.
I appreciate it. It was great talking to you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks.
Howard Wolfendale here on Trainer Talk. fun half hour. It's not all about the big names in the game. Of course, he's a pretty big name in the Mid-Atlantic states. Another name you're going to be hearing a lot of is Arnaud Delacour. You'll hear from him next in the second half of Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. The Fasic Tipton July sale takes place on Thursday, July 9th in Lexington, Kentucky, and is the number one ranked sale by runners and winners, and the number two ranked sale by grade one winners, graded stakes winners, and stakes horses, ranked second behind only the Fasic Tipton Saratoga sale. This year's July sale begins at 10 a.m., offering 332 yearlings. The sale is immediately followed by the Summer Selected Horses of Racing Age sale. 2013 and 2014 sale graduates have won no less than 188 races with earnings of over $5.5 million and have already won or placed in 37 stakes races to date. This year's sale will offer more than 100 horses with the Fasic Tipton website continually updated with features, video replays, DRFPPs, Rogozin sheets, and email alerts. It's the Fasic Tipton July sale, Thursday, July 9th in Lexington, Kentucky, the number one ranked sale by runners and winners.
And they're off to New York, the premier state-bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
On Sunday, July 5th, watch and wager on the $1 million Queen's Plate live from Woodbine Racetrack. This year's race marks the 156th running of the Queen's Plate, the first jewel in Canada's Triple Crown of Thoroughbred Racing. Woodbine will guarantee the early pick four pool at $150,000 and the late pick four pool at $300,000 and will be offering 20-cent bet minimums on all trifecta, superfecta, pick three, and pick four pools that afternoon. For more information, visit queensplate.com. Attention horsemen, Kentucky Downs is proud to announce a record $7.5 million in purses and KTDF money offered at the 2015 race meeting beginning September 5th. Overnight races will offer $120,000 purses for maiden special weight and as much as $130,000 for allowance races, plus three new stakes races and the meet's signature Grade 3 Kentucky Turf Cup offering a $600,000 purse on September 12th. Visit KentuckyDowns.com to download your 2015 condition book today. Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
The Breeders' Cup runs here.
Bayern, toast of New York, California Chrome. Bayern, toast of New York. Bayern has won it. Bayern got there by a head under Martin Garcia over toast of New York. It's untappable in front. Untappable the leader. Don't tell Sophia flying on the outside. Untappable gonna get there. Untappable has won it. Judy the Beauty sticks her neck out, goes for the wire. On the outside, Better Lucky's catching. Better Lucky, Judy the Beauty. Judy the Beauty, one and a head and eight thrillers. Main sequence finishing best of all. Late run from Twilight Eclipse. But it is main sequence to score. Main sequence is one and a head.
The Breeders' Cup, October 30th and 31st. Exclusively here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Cal Density. Go to horseracingradio.net for more information and to listen live.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and continuing this edition of Trainer Talk. Fun first half hour with Howard Wolfendale. Really enjoyable visit there, and looking forward to the second half of the program with trainer Arno Delacour. His story, much different than what we heard from Howard, but I think you're really going to enjoy it. It's a very interesting story, and looking forward to hearing from Arno in just a minute. But do want to remind you, if you did miss any portion of this program, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to a podcast at your leisure. It will be posted shortly after we finish up here this evening. So you can go there, check it out, horseracingradio.net, and access us on iTunes, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Arno Delacour is a native of Normandy, France, and he's only been training horses on his own since 2013, but in the past 2.5 years, he has saddled 87 winners, including a pair of greatest stakes winners with Ageless and Divining Rod, and he is with us now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Arno, congratulations on all the success.
Thank you very much, Mike. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for being with us here tonight, and I have to ask you, could you ever imagine your career getting off to this type of a start?
Not really, but I have to say it was kind of a progression, because we technically I started training 2 years ago, but I was training with my wife before that since 2006. So we are Lee de la Cour. So, I mean, we really built our clientele a little bit before those 2 years, you know. So it didn't happen suddenly, but it happened surely. So
your wife, Lee, is actually the reason for all your success.
She's a big help. That's a big part of it.
See how I set you up for that? You're supposed to say yes, absolutely. I tried to make you look good for her.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But, you know, we're really a team, so husband and wife team, and we talk about everything. So really, we attribute what we have to both of us, and we work hard at it.
What's the key to being successful when a trainer first goes out on their own?
Well, I guess, I mean, the main thing is to have a good work ethic and just try to, you know, have a good backup, I mean, good owners. And after that, you know, the horses come. I mean, we have nothing without good horses. That, there's no doubt about it. So we just need to work on our marketing a little bit when we start.
Yeah, and you worked with one of the best in Christophe Clément, and of course your wife Lee worked with another icon in Graham Motion, so you learned from some pretty good people. But even going back before that, you grew up in the Normandy region of France and worked for Alain de Royer Dupree for a while too.
I did, yeah. I worked for Alain de Royer Dupree when I was in my 20s. So that was my... I work at the farm before, you know. I've been introduced to a couple of different aspects of the game, but really training was my main, what I really like to do the most. Luckily enough, yeah, I got a job with Alain de Royer Dupree, which was a very good experience.
What was it like growing up in Normandy with all the history that took place with D-Day on those beaches?
Well, it was fun. I mean, it's a nice part of France. It's Normandy is a little bit what, I mean, to France, what Kentucky is to America. You know, that's where you have the best breeding, the best farms. So, I mean, I grew up in a nice setting. And as far as history, yes, you know, all my families, like grandfather, uncles, and a lot of people were involved in, you know, obviously the Second World War. So. Definitely full of history.
So were you always somebody that was interested in horses and maybe in the sport of horse racing, or were there other things that you kind of got into before horse racing?
No, I kind of pretty much got introduced to horse racing through my my stepfather. So my parents divorced when I was 11, and my mother got remarried with David Poyle, who has a farm, is a breeder, bloodstock agent, owner. So he's really the one that introduced me to the racing world. And since I'm 11, I pretty much knew that I wanted to follow that path.
Well, it's interesting. So many of our trainers that have joined me on this program have that same story, that they were introduced to the sport and then they really never wanted to do anything else. And it sounds like you're the same way, Arno.
That's correct.
So what was it that finally was kind of like that last straw that you said, hey, this is what I want to do. I want to train horses for a living.
Well, after high school, I had to make a choice. And I was not very enthusiastic about staying in school to do something that I didn't really care for. So it was just a nice opportunity to start working and making money and learning. So I started when I was like 18 years old. I made that choice to, start working with racehorses, and I've done that ever since.
How old were you when you first came to the United States?
I was not even 21, so I was 20.
Oh, wow. And what brought you here? What led to that decision?
Well, I was working in England at the time with John Gosden. I knew that Christophe Clément was, obviously starting to do very well in America, and he'd be one of the only trainers that could do a visa for European people, especially French people, because he knew all the right connection to do so. So we just asked Christophe if he'd be interested in, having someone like me for a year and a half and helped me to get a visa, and he did, and I'm glad he did.
Wow, that had to be a huge thrill for you. And I know that you probably weren't necessarily starstruck going to work for Christoph because you had been around other trainers like John Gosden. And so when you walk into Christoph's barn, you had to feel relatively comfortable, didn't you?
Well, I was, but it's a little bit different because everything was new to me. I mean, you know, I studied in a patient park in Florida, so it's an all different way of working, really, than we do in Europe. The organization of the barn, you know, working with hard workers, it's really structured, you know, hard worker, groom, exercise rider, assistant. It was a very, very efficient way it is a very efficient way of doing it, and I was a little bit... It took me a while to get acclimated, but I like it right away.
Yeah, talk about the difference in training horses here in the United States as opposed to training horses in Europe.
Well, in Europe, it takes way longer just because we don't really train on a racetrack. You have to go to the track from the barn or the stable, as they say. There's no really like a barn like we have in America with a shed row when you can pull out horses. So you pretty much... A set in Europe is probably an hour or more, so that's the fundamental. You know, as an exercise rider, you also groom and cool out your horse, so you pretty much do it all.
Tell me about some of the things that Christoph taught you that you're still using today, and that you're probably always going to use.
Well, a lot. I got a lot of things from Christoph, you know. First of all, as I said before, a strong work ethic. Christoph, you know, is amazing in that regard. You know, he's always at the barn and always looking at his horses and his staff. So, I mean, that stayed with me a little bit, you know. And a lot of horsemanship, I suppose, you know. And from time to time, if I have a doubt about something, I call Christoph, and he's always very helpful.
Yeah, it's interesting because we'll hear trainers talk about having other colleagues that are trainers and other colleagues that are considered to be horsemen. And I've always considered Christoph to be more of a horseman than necessarily a trainer. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. It depends what your definition of trainer is, you know. I mean, the people I learned from were that kind of trainer, you know. Alan Ray Dupre or Christoph, they are people that are very close to their horses.
Yep.
And I consider like really tremendous horsemen.
Talking with trainer Arno Delacour here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Arno, I read a quote from your wife, Lee, where she said that we like to say we've got a Harvard MBA in horse racing since we were inside the training operations of Graham and Christoph. Do you agree?
Yes, I mean I would say that's a big edge to work for stable of that caliber, you know, a trainer of that caliber. You get to see places, good horses, good horsemen, and of course you learn from it.
Were you there for the Gio Ponti years, or was that before you?
No, that was after me.
Oh, it was after you. Okay. All right.
Yes.
So then when you look at what you've done then going out on your own, what led to that decision to work with Lee and to say, okay, we're going to make a go of this on our own?
It was kind of a logical thing to do for us. I've worked for Christoph for 6 years, and every 2 years I've done something different for him. Like the first 2 years I was at Monmouth Park with a small string of horses. Then the following 2 years I was the shipping assistant, and the last 2 years I was with Christoph, I had a bigger string of horses in Saratoga. So to me it was I've seen pretty much all the aspects of the operation during those 6 years. And if after that, I thought I was ready to give it a shot, ready.
Yeah, and you and Lee have always been much more focused on the quality aspect as opposed to quantity and having big numbers in your stable. And it seems to be serving you well.
Well, that's correct. We're lucky enough to have some very good owners to train for. Therefore, we don't have ready to have a lot of horses, and hoping that you know we can get one good one. I mean, it is a number game anyway, but you know by limiting the number of horses and really keeping what we consider being a useful or good stock helped us because we can focus more on better horses, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you would think that as an operation that doesn't have gigantic numbers, you don't have 200 horses in your stable, that you would be more concerned about getting those horses to the track and to the races, but you're very patient too. And if a horse needs a break, you're not afraid to let them develop and give them time.
Yeah, that's a little bit the way we see it. We like to evaluate a horse fully and try to, you know, bring them to their full potential. Sometimes it takes time and you realize that, you know, you don't have much horse. But you know, in the benefit of the doubt, we always take our time and try to bring them at their best level.
So if you were going to sum up your training philosophy, Arno, how would you do it? How would you describe your approach?
Well, we're really progressive, I would say. We train mainly for owner breeders, so people that are not in a hurry but really are trying to evaluate their horses, especially with fillies. I mean, you know how it is. Try to get some black type, try to get the families moving, you know. So in that regard, we're really progressive. And sometimes it's not about winning a race, but it's what's going to happen on the long run.
Take me back to that day at Delaware Park. A horse by the name of Margano provided you with your first stakes win. What do you remember about that day?
Well, I remember that we were very lucky that day because it was a stakes that was carded on the turf with a couple of men track-only horses who were very tough. And it didn't rain before 1 o'clock, so all the men track-only scratched. And they took the race off the turf like probably an hour before our race. So that left us with like a very small competition, and Margano loved the slope of the mud. So we were just very happy about the circumstances, but we were also a little bit lucky.
Yeah, sometimes better to be lucky than good, right?
I agree.
And then, of course, last year you make your Breeders' Cup debut with Ageless, who ran in the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint. Talk to me about that Breeders' Cup experience.
That was really a fun week. Everything went well. The city shipped well. California was a great setting for the Breeders' Cup. You know, the weather was perfect. And we all had a good time, you know. Went there with the Jacksons. They had a good time too, and it was really, really a fun place to be.
Yeah, that's become a really nice relationship for you with Roy and Gretchen Jackson. Talk about that.
Well, yes, it is. I mean, thanks to them to, you know, trust us in what we do. And they live probably 30 minutes from Fairhill, so they like to come and watch their horses train every Saturday. And so we talk about everything, about the horses, you know, and they seem to like it. They're really, really, really good people to work for.
Is there more pressure training a horse when the owner's standing there next to you as opposed to when they're not there?
I don't think so.
No?
No. I don't think so. That don't bother me. Sometimes if you have too many, like it's the case in Saratoga or big places, sometimes as a trainer you're so overwhelmed that you can't really focus on your training. You kind of focus more on your clients, you know, and the owner, and that's sometimes a little bit overwhelming. But for me to train with the Jackson coming, we breeze our fish, it's very easy. It helps that the Jackson are like very good horsemen. They know horses, they know all the aspects of the game. So really there's nothing to explain or hide or, you know, they see it like we do.
Yeah, that makes a big difference.
That's really Yeah, that doesn't make a big difference. All right.
Well, this past spring, we were at Keeneland doing a race broadcast covering the Coolmore Lexington, and that was a day where you had the opportunity to reward the Gretchens with another greatest, the Jacksons with another greatest stakes win, and you did it with their homebred divining rod. Tell me about that day.
That was wonderful. I really like Keeneland. I mean, that's what I've always told Mr. and Mrs. Jackson, that, you know, if we had to step up a horse, I'd like to try him at Keeneland, because that's a great place. We can go there early. We can paddock school. I think everything is done in a very horseman way. So it was a great experience.
And then you got a chance to run him in the Preakness Stakes. You skip the Derby, you go to the Preakness. Of course, we were there that day as well. We're covering the races, and right before the race, the skies open up. They turned just pitch black, and I can only imagine what that was like for you in the pre-race.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was meant to be, you know, because after the Preakness, he wasn't running anymore, and just during it, he poured. But, yeah, that was amazing, because we were in the infield, and one of the things that we can control, you know, start blowing very hard and raining hard, and all the TV screens were, you know, bouncing left and right. So that was a very apocalyptic type of scenery. But I'm glad that everybody came back in good shape, and it was overall a good day.
Yeah, and of course the horse ran so well, you had to be so proud of him. What was it like for you being part of a triple crown race as the trainer?
It means a lot. I mean, that's, you really realize that what it means when the involvement of the press, the exposure, all the sponsors, that was a really, really good experience. I'm very happy that the horse showed up and, you know, was able to finish the race like that.
Is there a difference, Arno, in saddling a horse in a big race like that as opposed to just your everyday allowance race? Is it a different feeling or a different approach?
Not really. Not to me. I think the day of the race is pretty much the same for each horse. I mean, as far as I'm concerned. We just go in the paddock. There's a little bit of an apprehension. You know, you hope that everything is well. Really, what changes to me is the 2 weeks prior to the race, where you really focus on the training, that everything needs to go well. And that's the stressful part. But the actual day of the race, I don't think that's a big deal. And it's not very different than any other day.
Visiting with trainer Arno Delacour on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Arno, I've often heard you and your wife refer to your operation as a team operation. What does that mean?
Well, it is correct. Lee rides. I used to ride, but I don't anymore. Busy doing a lot of other things. So we really talk about each horse and what we think about the horse, where we think we should run him. So that's very important to me, as we can help each other all the time.
Yeah, I saw where Lee graduated from the University of Virginia. She has degrees in both biology and economics, but she said that the diplomas are actually hanging in her mom's laundry room. Not getting a lot of use out of those right now.
No, she doesn't, but there's no doubt about the fact that she's the smart one in the couple, you know.
Well, I guess you have Graham and his wife, Anita, to thank for this new relationship, right?
Yes, definitely. They were very nice, very helpful. Socially we see each other, and Lee really kept a good contact with Graham and Anita. So, and they were both a role model for her growing up, so that meant a lot.
And how about your children? You have a couple of young children. Do you see them eventually maybe getting involved in horse racing at some point?
It's hard to say. They're a little bit too young for that. They're 1 and 3. So we'll see where it leads. I mean, for sure, we're going to try to expose them as much as we can. Then they'll make up their own mind. my buddies.
I always find that interesting when trainers come on and they have young children like that, because let's face it, Arnaud, this is a profession that is 24/7, 365 days a year. You don't get days off. You're doing a lot of traveling. Lee's in different parts of the country when you're traveling as well. How do you balance that professional life with your personal life?
Well, it's a little bit difficult for me to speak about it now because our children are young, so it's very easy. Just put them in a plane and ship them to Tampa where we are for the winter and Ferrill where we are for the summer. So that's very easy at the moment. But I'm sure that it'll get a little bit trickier once they start going to school and have like other activities. But a lot of people, like, you know, my experience with Christoph, just it is manageable, you know, it's just a little bit of effort, but it is manageable.
Did I read somewhere that when you're in Florida at Tampa Bay Downs, you get a little help watching the kids from claims clerk Brenda Jones?
Yes. That's actually not a little help, it's a big, big help.
I can only imagine. Arnaud Delacour on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on HRRN. Arnaud, just a few minutes left. This is has really flown by. But tell me about some of the people that have helped you along the way. And outside of Christoph and outside of John Gosden and those people that you had a chance to be around, who are some of the other people, maybe owners or other people that have helped you?
Well, to begin with, my stepfather, David Powell, who really introduced me to the racing world in a big way. You know, it's like you're going there by the big door, you know. I was introduced to good professionals where I learned from. So he's really someone that was really influenced in my life and my decision to be in horse racing, to be a horse trainer. And after, I think Christoph would be the one that was the most influential on me.
So in the rare time that you're not at the racetrack and you get a little break from everything, and I know that that doesn't happen very often, but what other hobbies or interests does Arnaud Delacour have?
Well, in the last 3 years, to be honest with you, it's been taking care of children, of young children. So our social life has been a little bit slow lately, but other than that, if I have the occasion, I like to play tennis and, you know, follow a little bit of sports and stuff like that. But mainly it's horse racing for me.
Will you encourage the kids to get involved in racing and maybe even become trainers at some point?
I would if it's what they like. They would like to do, you know. I don't think I would push them one way or the other, but just being exposed to what we do, and if they enjoy it and have a passion for it, I would definitely, you know, help them or try to help them the best I can. Yeah.
Arnaud, what's the best part of being a horse trainer?
Well, That's a tricky question. There's different aspects that I really like. The first one being in the morning with the horses. There's no doubt about it that, you know, like a sunny day like today, looking at your horses train and you know, develop a team of people that can take care of them is a big satisfaction to me. But of course, like in the afternoon when you saddle a horse and win a race, there's nothing like it, you know. I mean, that's a lot of adrenaline going on.
Yeah, very well said. Arnaud Delacour here, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Arnaud, appreciate the time. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, you're going to receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors. That is Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So I will send those to you. And again, can't thank you enough and want to wish you and your wife, Lee, all the best moving forward and continued success, my friend.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Arnaud Delacour on Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Of course, Howard Wolfendale with me in the first half of the program. And another reminder, if you did miss any portion of this show or any of our Trainer Talk shows, our Jock Talk shows, our Thursday night Brisnet.com call-in shows, or the Express Bet weekend stakes previews on Fridays, even the Equine Forum on Saturday mornings, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast of all of those programs. It's all there for you. You click the show tab at the top of the homepage, and it'll take you right to the page with every single podcast. Check them out now, horseracingradio.net. Been a really fun show. Always fun to catch up with some of the people that make our sport go. And yeah, you know I'm talking about the trainers. Howard Wolfendale, Arno Delacour. Special thanks to each of them. And of course, to my producer, Lee Delapina, for pushing all the right buttons here in our Lexington studios. I am Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.